agonizingly slow. Alison kept looking back, but there was no pursuit yet. Even if they realized the Queen had gone, what could they do? They would have to mend one of the remaining boats before they could give chase. She began to believe they were free. As they approached the mainland, Alison saw the figure of a man she did not recognize, waiting on the shore. "Hell," she said, "who's that?" She was possessed by a terrible fear that they had come this far only to be trapped again. Willie looked over his shoulder. "That's Alistair Hugh. He's with George." Alison's heartbeat slowed again. They reached the shore and jumped out of the boat. Alistair led them along a path between houses. Alison heard horses stamping and snorting impatiently. The escapers emerged onto the main road through the village, and there was Pretty Geordie, smiling in triumph, surrounded by armed men. Horses were saddled ready for the fugitives. George helped Mary onto her mount, and Willie had the joy of holding Alison's foot while she swung herself up. Then they all rode out of the village to freedom. Exactly 2 weeks later, Alison was convinced that Mary was about to make the greatest mistake of her life. Mary and Alison were at Dundrennan Abbey, on the south coast of Scotland, across the Solway Firth from England. Dundrennan had been the grandest monastery in Scotland. The monasteries had been secularized, but there was still a magnificent Gothic church and an extensive range of comfortable quarters. Mary and Alison sat alone in what had been the abbot's luxurious suite of rooms, grimly contemplating their future. Everything had gone wrong for Queen Mary again. Mary's army had met the forces of her brother, James Stuart, at a village called Langside, near Glasgow. Mary had ridden with her men, and had been so brave that they had had to restrain her from leading the charge. But all the same she had been defeated, and now she was on the run again. She had ridden south, across bleak, wind-swept moorland, burning bridges behind her to slow pursuit. One miserable evening, Alison had cut off all Mary's lovely auburn hair, to make her less easily recognizable, and now she was wearing a dull brown wig. It seemed to complete her wretchedness. She wanted to go to England, and Alison was trying to talk her out of it. "You still have thousands of supporters," Alison said brightly. "Most Scots people are Catholic. Only upstarts and merchants are Protestant." "An exaggeration, but with some truth," Mary said. "You can regroup, assemble a bigger army, try again." Mary shook her head. "I had the larger army at Langside. It seems I cannot win the civil war without outside help." "Then let us go back to France. You have lands there and money." "In France, I am an ex-queen. I feel too young for that role." Mary was an ex-queen everywhere, Alison thought, but she did not say it. "Your French relations are the most powerful family in the country. They might assemble an army to back you if you ask them personally." "If I go to France now, I will never return to Scotland." "I know it." "So you're determined I will go to England?" They had had this discussion several times, and each time Mary had come to the same conclusion. She went on. "Elizabeth may be a Protestant, but she believes that a monarch who has been anointed with holy oils, as I was when I was 9 months old, rules by divine right. She cannot validate a usurper such as my brother James. She is in too much danger of being usurped herself." Alison was not sure how precarious Elizabeth's position was. She had been queen for 10 years without serious opposition, but perhaps all monarchs felt vulnerable. Mary went on, "Elizabeth must help me regain my throne. No one else thinks that." It was true. All the noblemen who had fought at Langside and had accompanied Mary on her flight south were opposed to her plan. But she would make up her own mind, as always. "I'm right," she said, "and they're wrong." Mary had always been willful, Alison thought, but this was almost suicidal. Mary stood up. "It's time to go." They went outside. George and Willie were waiting in front of the church, with a farewell party of noblemen and a small group of servants who would accompany the Queen. They mounted horses and followed a grassy track alongside a stream that ran, gurgling and chuckling, through the abbey grounds toward the sea. The path went through spring-green woodland, sprinkled with wildflowers. Then the vegetation changed to tough gorse bushes, splashed with deep golden-yellow blossoms. Spring blooms signaled hope, but Alison had none. They reached a wide pebble beach where the stream emptied into the sea. A fishing boat waited at a crude wooden jetty. On the jetty, Mary stopped, turned, and spoke directly to Alison in a low voice.
"You don't have to come," she said.
It was true. Alison could walk away. Mary's enemies would leave her alone, seeing no danger. They would think a mere lady-in-waiting could not organize a counter-revolution, and they would be right. Alison had an amiable uncle in Stirling who would take her in. She might marry again. She was certainly young enough. But the prospect of freedom without Mary seemed the most dismal of all possible outcomes. She had spent her life serving Mary. Even during the long empty weeks and months at Lochleven, she had wanted nothing else. She was imprisoned not by stone walls, but by her love.
"Well," said Mary, "will you come?" "Of course I will," Alison said.
They got into the boat.
"We could still go to France," Alison said desperately.
Mary smiled.
"There is one factor you overlook," she said. "The Pope and all the monarchs of Europe believe that Elizabeth is an illegitimate child. Therefore, she was never entitled to the throne of England."
She paused, looking across the 20 miles of water to the far side of the estuary. Following her gaze, Alison saw, dimmed by haze, the low green hills of England.
"And if Elizabeth is not Queen of England," said Mary, "then I am."
"Scottish Mary has arrived in Carlisle," said Ned Willard to Queen Elizabeth in the presence chamber at Whitehall Palace. The Queen expected Ned to know such things, and he made it his job to have answers ready. That was why she had made him Sir Ned. "She's moved into the castle there," Ned went on, "and the Deputy Governor of Carlisle has written to you asking what he should do with her." Carlisle was in the far northwest corner of England, and close to the Scottish border, which was why there was a fortress there. Elizabeth paced the room, her magnificent silk gown rustling with her impatient steps.
"What the devil shall I tell him?"
Elizabeth was 34. For 10 years she had ruled England with a firm hand. She had a confident grasp of European politics, navigating those treacherous tides and undercurrents with Sir William Cecil as her pilot. But she did not know what to do about Mary. The Queen of the Scots was a problem with no satisfactory solution.
"I can't have Scottish Mary running around England, stirring up discontent among the Catholics,"
Elizabeth said with frustration.
"They would start saying she is the rightful queen, and we'd have a rebellion to deal with before you could say transubstantiation."
Cecil, the lawyer, said, "You don't have to let her stay. She is a foreign monarch on English soil without your permission, which is at least a discourtesy and could even be interpreted as an invasion."
"People would call me heartless," Elizabeth said, "throwing her to the Scottish wolves."
Ned knew that Elizabeth could be heartless when it suited her. However, she was always sensitive to what the English people would think of her actions. Ned said, "What Mary wants is for you to send an English army to Scotland to help her regain her rightful throne."
"I haven't got the money,"
Elizabeth said quickly. She hated war, and she hated spending money. Neither Ned nor Cecil was surprised at her instant rejection of this possibility. Cecil said, "Failing your assistance, she may ask her French relatives to help her, and we don't want a French army in Scotland."
"God forbid."
"Amen," said Cecil. "And let's not forget that when she was married to Francis, they called themselves King and Queen of France, Scotland, England, and Ireland. She even had it on her tableware. Mary's French family have ambitions without limit, in my opinion."
"She's a thorn in my foot," Elizabeth said. "God's body, what am I to do?"
Ned recalled his encounter with Mary 7 years ago at Saint-Dizier. She was striking-looking, taller than Ned, and beautiful in an ethereal way. He had thought she was brave but impulsive, and he had imagined she might make decisions that were bold but unwise. Coming to England was almost certainly a wrong move for her. He also remembered her companion, Alison Mackay, a woman of about his own age, dark-haired and blue-eyed, not as beautiful as Mary, but probably wiser. and there had been an arrogant young courtier with them called Pierre Aumont de Guise. Ned had disliked him instantly. Cecil and Ned already knew what decision Elizabeth must make, but they knew her too well to try to tell her what to do. So they had taken her through the available choices, letting her rule out the bad ones herself. Now Cecil assumed a casual tone of voice as he put to her the option he wanted her to decide on. "You could just incarcerate her."
"Here in England?"
"Yes. Let her stay, but keep her prisoner. It has certain advantages." Cecil and Ned had made this list together, but Cecil spoke as if the advantages had only just occurred to him. "You would always know where she is. She would not be free to foment a rebellion, and it would weaken the Scots Catholics if their figurehead were captive in a foreign country. But she would be here, and the English Catholics would know it." "That is a drawback," Cecil said, "but perhaps we could take steps to prevent her communicating with malcontents, or with anyone else, come to that." In practice, Ned suspected, it might be difficult to keep a prisoner totally incommunicado. But Elizabeth's mind went in a different direction.
"I would be quite justified in locking her up," she mused.
"She has called herself Queen of England. What would Felipe do to a man who said he was the rightful King of Spain?"
"Execute him, of course," said Cecil promptly.
"In fact," Elizabeth said, talking herself into doing what she wanted to do,
"it would be merciful of me merely to imprison Mary."
"I think that's how it would be seen," Cecil said.
"I think that's the solution," she said. "Thank you, Cecil. What would I do without you?"
"Your Majesty is kind."
The Queen turned to Ned. "You'd better go to Carlisle and make sure it's done properly," she said.
"Very good, Your Majesty," said Ned. "What shall I say is the reason for detaining Mary? We don't want people to say her imprisonment is unlawful."
"Good point," said Elizabeth. "I don't know."
"As to that," said Cecil, "I have a suggestion." Carlisle was a formidable fortress with a long defensive wall pierced only by a narrow gateway. The castle was made of pinkish-red local sandstone, the same as the cathedral that stood opposite. Within the wall was a square tower with cannons on its roof. The guns were all pointed towards Scotland. Alison and Mary were housed in a smaller tower in a corner of the compound. It was just as dark as Loch Leven, and cold, even in June. Alison wished they had horses, so that they could go for rides, something Mary had always loved and had missed badly at Loch Leven. But they had to content themselves with walking, escorted always by a troop of English soldiers. Mary decided not to press her complaints to Elizabeth. All that mattered was that the Queen of England should help her regain her Scottish throne. Today they expected the long-awaited emissary from Elizabeth's court. He had arrived late last night and retired immediately. Alison had managed to get messages to Mary's friends in Scotland, and as a result, some clothes and wigs had arrived, though her jewellery, much of it given to her by King Francis II when she was Queen of France, was still in the Protestant grasp of her half-brother. However, she had been able to make herself look royal this morning. After breakfast, they sat in the mean little room they inhabited at the castle, waiting to hear their fate. They had discussed Elizabeth night and day for a month, talking over her religious convictions, her beliefs about monarchy, her reputed learning, and her famously imperious personality. They had tried to guess what decision she would make. Would she help Mary regain her throne or not? They had reached no conclusion, or rather, they had reached a different conclusion every day. But now, they would find out. Elizabeth's messenger was a little older than Alison, almost 30, she guessed. He was slim, with a pleasant smile and golden brown eyes. His clothes were good, but unostentatious. Looking closely, Alison was surprised to recognize him. She glanced at Mary and saw a slight frown, as if she, too, was trying to place him. As he bowed low to the Queen and nodded to Alison, she remembered where they had met.
"Saint-Dizier," she said.
7 years ago," he said. He spoke French. He knew, or had guessed, that Mary was most comfortable in this tongue, Scots being her second language and English a distant third. His manner was polite but relaxed. I'm Sir Ned Willand. Alison thought his careful good manners cloaked a dangerous toughness, like a velvet scabbard for a sharp-edged sword. She spoke warmly in an attempt to soften him.
Sir Ned, now, she said. Congratulations.
You're very kind. Alison remembered that Ned had pretended to be merely a clerk to James Stewart, a pretense that had been revealed when he spoke so challengingly to Pierre Aumond. Mary said, You tried to persuade me not to go to Scotland. You should have taken my advice, he said unsmilingly. Mary ignored that and got down to business. I am the Queen of Scotland, she said. Queen Elizabeth won't deny that.
No, indeed, said Ned.
I was illegally imprisoned by traitors among my subjects. Again, I feel sure my cousin Elizabeth will agree. They were not quite cousins, of course, but more distantly related. Elizabeth's grandfather, King Henry VII of England, was Mary's great-grandfather. But Sir Ned did not quibble. Mary went on, And I came here to England of my own free will. All I ask is the chance to speak to Elizabeth in person and to beg for her assistance. I will certainly give her that message, said Ned. Alison suppressed a groan of disappointment. Ned was prevaricating. That was bad news. Mary bristled.
Give her the message? She said indignantly. I expected you to bring me her decision.
Ned was not flustered. Perhaps it was not the first time he had had to deal with an angry queen. Her Majesty can't make such a decision immediately, he said in the calm tones of reason.
Why not?
Other matters must be resolved first. Mary was not to be fobbed off that easily.
What matters?
Ned said reluctantly. The death of your husband, Lord Darnley, the King Consort of Scotland, and the cousin of Queen Elizabeth, remains unexplained.
That is nothing to do with me.
I believe you, said Ned. Alison suspected he did not. And Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth believes you. That was not true either. But we must establish the facts to the satisfaction of the world before you can be received at Elizabeth's court. Her Majesty hopes that you, as a queen yourself, will understand that. This was rejection, Alison thought, and she wanted to weep. The murder of Darnley was not the real issue. It was a pretext. The plain fact was that Elizabeth did not want to meet Mary. And that meant she did not want to help Mary. Mary came to the same conclusion.
This is cruelly unjust, she said, standing up.
Her face reddened and tears came to her eyes.
How can my cousin treat me so coldly?
She asks you to be patient. She will provide for all your needs, meanwhile.
I do not accept this decision. I shall sail to France. My family there will give me the help Elizabeth denies me.
Queen Elizabeth would not want you to bring a French army to Scotland.
Then I shall simply go back to Edinburgh and take my chances against my treacherous half-brother, your friend, James Stewart.
Ned hesitated. Alison saw that his face was a little pale, and he clasped his hands behind his back as if to stop himself fidgeting uneasily. The wrath of a queen was a dreadful sight, but Ned held all the cards. His voice, when he spoke, was strong, and his words were uncompromising. I'm afraid that will not be possible. It was Mary's turn to look fearful.
What on earth can you mean?
The Queen's orders are that you shall remain here until the English courts can clear you of complicity in the murder of Lord Darnley. Alison felt tears come to her eyes.
No,
she cried. This was the worst possible outcome. I'm sorry to bring you such unwelcome news, he said, and Alison believed he meant it. He was a kind man with an unkind message. Mary's voice was shaky.
So Queen Elizabeth will not receive me at court?
No, said Ned.
She will not let me go to France?
No, he said again.
And I may not return home to Scotland?
No, Ned said for the third time.
So I am a prisoner?
Yes, said Ned.
Again,
said Mary. Chapter 16. When his mother died, Ned felt sad and bereft and alone. But most of all, he felt angry. Alice Willard's last years should have been luxurious and triumphant. Instead, she had been ruined by a religious quarrel, and had died thinking herself a failure. It was Easter, 1570. By chance, Barney was at home, in a short break between sea voyages. On Easter Monday, the brothers celebrated the resurrection of the dead in Kingsbridge Cathedral. Then the next day they stood side by side in the cemetery, as their mother's coffin was lowered into the grave where their father already lay. There was hot resentment in Ned's stomach, bilious and sour, and he vowed again to spend his life making sure that men such as Bishop Julius would not have the power to destroy honest merchants like Alice Willard. As they walked away from the grave, Ned tried to turn his mind to practical matters, and he said to Barney, "The house is yours, of course." Barney was the elder son. He had shaved off his bushy beard to reveal a face that was prematurely aged, at 32, by cold salt water winds and the glare of the unshaded sun. He said, "I know, but I have little use for it. Please live there whenever you're in Kingsbridge." "Is seafaring going to be your life, then?"
"Yes."
Barney had prospered. After the Hawk, he had been made captain of another vessel, with a share in the profits, and then he had bought his own ship. He had their mother's knack for making money. Ned looked across the market square to the house where he had been born. He loved the old place, with its view of the cathedral. "I'll be glad to take care of it for you. The Fifes will do the work, but I'll keep an eye on them." Janet and Malcolm Fife were housekeeper and groom. "They're getting old," Barney said. "They're in their 50s, but Eileen is only 22. And perhaps she might marry a man who would like to take over Malcolm's job." Ned knew better. "Eileen will never marry anyone but you, Barney." Barney shrugged. Many women had fallen hopelessly in love with him. Poor Eileen was just another one. Ned said, "Aren't you ever tempted to settle down? There's no point. A sailor hardly ever sees his wife. What about you?" Ned thought for a minute. The death of his mother had made him aware that his time on earth was limited. Of course he had known that before, but now it was brought home to him, and it made him ask himself if the life he led was the one he really wanted. He surprised himself with his answer to Barney's question. "I want what they had," he said, looking back at the grave where both parents lay. "A lifelong partnership." Barney said, "They started early. They were married at 20 or thereabouts, weren't they? You're already 10 years behind schedule." "I don't live the life of a monk." "I'm glad to hear it. But somehow I never come across a woman I want to spend my life with." "With one exception," said Barney, looking over Ned's shoulder. Ned turned and saw Marjorie Fitzgerald. She must have been in church during the service, but he had not seen her in the crowd. Now his heart faltered. She had dressed somberly for the funeral, but as always she wore a hat, today a purple velvet cap pinned at an angle to her luxuriant curls. She was speaking earnestly to old Father Paul, a former monk at Kingsbridge Priory, now a canon at the cathedral, and probably a secret Catholic. Marjorie's obstinate Catholicism should have repelled Ned, but on the contrary, he admired her idealism. "I'm afraid there's only one of her, and she married someone else," he said. This was a fruitless subject of discussion, he thought, impatiently. He said, "Where will your next sea voyage take you? I want to go to the New World again. I don't like the slave trade. The cargo is too liable to die on the voyage. But over there they need just about everything, except sugar." Ned smiled. "And I seem to remember you mentioning a girl."
"Did I? When?"
"That sounds to me like a yes." Barney looked bashful, as if he did not want to admit to a deeper feeling.
"Well, it's true that I've never met anyone like Bella.
That was 7 years ago."
"I know. She's probably married to a wealthy planter by now, with 2 or 3 children."
"But you want to find out for sure." Ned was quite surprised. "You're not very different from me after all." They drifted toward the ruined monastery.
"The church never did anything with these old buildings," Ned said. "Mother had a dream of turning them into an indoor market."
"She was smart. It's a good idea. We should do it one day." "I'll never have enough money."
"I might, though, if the sea is kind to me."
Marjorie approached, followed by a lady-in-waiting and a man-at-arms. She rarely went anywhere alone, now that she was the Countess of Shiring. Her little retinue stood a few yards off as she shook Barney's hand, then Ned's, and said, "What a sad day." Barney said, "Thank you, Marjorie. But a wonderful crowd for the funeral. Your mother was very much loved."
"Indeed."
"Bart begs your pardon for not being here. He had to go to Winchester." Barney said, "Will you excuse me? I have to speak to Dan Cobley. I want him to invest in my next voyage, to spread the risk." He moved away, leaving Ned alone with Marjorie. Marjorie's voice changed to a low, intimate tone. "How are you, Ned?"
"My mother was 60, so it wasn't a shock to me," Ned said. That was what he told everyone, but it was glib, and he felt an urge to say more to Marjorie.
He added bleakly, "But you only get one mother."
"I know. I didn't even like my father, especially after he made me marry Bart. But all the same, I cried when he passed away."
"That generation is almost gone." Ned smiled. "Remember that 12th night party, 12 years ago, when William Cecil came? In those days they seemed to rule the world. Your father, my mother, and Bart's father." Marjorie's eyes glinted with mischief.
"Of course I remember."
Ned knew she was thinking of the fevered minutes they had spent kissing in the disused bread oven. He smiled at the memory. On impulse, he said, "Come to the house for a cup of wine. Let's talk about old times. This is a day for remembering." They threaded their way slowly through the market. It was crowded. Business did not stop for a funeral. They crossed the main street and went into the Willard house. Ned showed Marjorie into the little front parlour, where his mother had always sat, with the view of the west front of the cathedral. Marjorie turned to the two servants who had followed her in.
"You two can go to the kitchen."
Ned said, "Janet Fife will give you a mug of ale and something to eat, and please ask her to bring wine for your mistress and me." They went away, and Ned closed the door.
"How is your baby?" he said. "Bartlett isn't a baby any longer," she said. "He's 6 years old, walking and talking like a grown-up and carrying a wooden sword."
"And Bart has no idea."
"Don't even say it."
Marjorie lowered her voice to a whisper.
"Now that Swithin's dead, you and I are the only people who know. We must keep the secret forever."
"Of course." Marjorie was quite sure that Bartlett had been fathered by Swithin, not Bart. And Ned thought she was almost certainly right. In 12 years of marriage, she had conceived only once, and that was when her father-in-law raped her. He said, "Does it change how you feel?"
"About Bartlett? No. I adored him from the moment I saw him."
"And Bart?"
"Also dotes on him.
The fact that Bartlett looks like Swithin seems quite natural, of course. Bart wants to turn the boy into a copy of himself in every way." "But that's natural, too."
"Listen, Ned. I know men think that if a woman conceives, that means she enjoyed it.
I don't believe that."
"Because it isn't true. Ask any woman."
Ned saw that she was desperate for reassurance. "I don't need to ask anyone."
"Really? You don't think I lured Swithin, do you?"
"Certainly not."
"I hope you feel sure."
"I'm more sure of that than of my own name." Tears came to her eyes.
"Thank you."
Ned took her hand. After a minute she said,
"Can I ask you another question?"
"All right."
"Has there been anyone else?"
He hesitated. The pause was enough for her.
"So there has," she said.
"I'm sorry, but I'm not a monk."
"More than one, then?"
Ned said nothing.
Marjorie said, "Years ago, Susanna Brecknock told me she had a lover half her age. It was you, wasn't it?"
Ned was amazed by the accuracy of her intuition. "How did you guess?"
"It just seems right. She said he didn't love her, but she didn't care, because he was such fun to lie with."
Ned was embarrassed that two women had discussed him in this way. "Are you angry?" he said.
"I have no right to be. I lie with Bart. Why should you be celibate?"
"But you were forced to marry, and you were seduced by a woman with a warm heart and a soft body."
"I'm not angry. I just envy her."
Ned raised her hand to his lips. The door opened and Ned hastily pulled his hand away. The housekeeper came in with a jug of wine and a plate of nuts and dried fruits. Marjorie said kindly,
"This is a sad day for you too, Janet."
Janet burst into tears and left without speaking.
Poor thing, said Marjorie. She's worked for my mother since she was a girl. Ned wanted to hold Marjorie's hand again, but he restrained himself. Instead, he brought up a new topic. I need to talk to Bart about a small problem.
Oh? What?
The Queen has made me Lord of Wiggly.
Congratulations.
Now you'll be rich. Not rich, but comfortable. Ned would collect rents from all the farmers in the village. It was how monarchs often paid their advisers, especially penny-pinching rulers, such as Elizabeth. Marjorie said, So now you're Sir Ned Willard of Wiggly. My father always said Wiggly traditionally belonged to our family. He thought we were descended from Merthyn the bridge builder. According to Timothy's book, Merthyn's brother Ralph was Lord of Wiggly, and Merthyn built the watermill that is still there.
So you're descended from nobility.
Gentry, at least. So what's the problem you need to discuss with Bart? One of my tenants has cleared some of the forest beyond the stream, on land that belongs to you. He had no right, of course. Tenants were always trying to increase the size of their holdings surreptitiously. But I don't like to punish enterprise, so I want to work out some agreement that will compensate Bart for the loss of a couple of acres.
Why don't you come to Newcastle for dinner one day next week and talk to him?
All right.
Friday at noon?
Suddenly Ned felt happy.
Yes,
he said. Friday's fine. Marjorie was ashamed of how excited she felt about Ned's visit. She believed in fidelity. Even though she had been forced to marry Bart, her duty was to be loyal to him. It made no difference that he was growing more like his late father, oafish and bullying and promiscuous. There were no excuses for Marjorie. Sin was sin. She was embarrassed by the flush of desire that had overwhelmed her when Ned promised to visit Newcastle. She vowed to treat him with careful courtesy, and no more warmth than any polite hostess would show a distinguished guest. She wished he would fall in love and marry someone else, and lose interest in her. Then perhaps they could think of one another calmly, as old flames that had sputtered out long ago. The day before, she had ordered the cook to kill and pluck a pair of fat geese, and in the morning she was heading for the kitchen to give instructions for the cooking when she saw a girl coming out of Bart's room. It was Nora Josephs, she saw, the youngest of the housemaids, at 15. Her hair was untidy, and she had evidently dressed in haste. She was not pretty, but she had the plump kind of young body that appealed to Bart. They had had separate bedrooms for about 5 years now. Marjorie preferred it this way. Bart still came to her bed now and again, but less and less often. She knew that he had other women, but, she told herself, she did not care, because she did not love him. All the same, she wished with all her heart that she could have had a different kind of marriage. As far as she knew, none of his mistresses had ever become pregnant. However, Bart seemed never to question why. He did not have a very logical mind, and if he thought about it at all, he probably told himself it was God's will. Marjorie was prepared to pretend she had not noticed, but young Nora gave her a saucy look, and that was a bad sign. Marjorie was not willing to be humiliated, and she decided she had better deal with Nora immediately. It was not the first time she had found herself in this situation, and she knew what to do.
"Come with me, girl," she said in her most authoritative voice, and Nora did not dare to disobey.
They went into Marjorie's boudoir. Marjorie sat down and left Nora standing. The girl looked scared now, so perhaps there was hope for her.
Listen to me carefully, because the whole of the rest of your life depends on how you behave now,
Marjorie said.
Do you understand me?
Yes, madam.
If you choose, you may flaunt your relationship with the Earl. You can touch him in front of the other servants. You can show off the gifts he gives you. You can even shame me by kissing him in my presence. Everyone in this house, and half the people in the county of Shiring, will know that you are the Earl's mistress. You will feel proud.
She paused. Nora could not meet her eye.
But what will happen when he tires of you? I will throw you out, of course, and Bart won't care.
You will try to find work as a maid in another house, and then you'll realize that no woman is going to take you on, because they'll all think you're going to seduce their husbands.
And do you know where you'll end up? She paused, and Nora whispered,
"No, madam."
In a waterfront brothel at Coombe Harbour, sucking the cocks of 10 sailors a night, and you'll die of a horrible disease.
Marjorie did not really know what went on in brothels, but she managed to sound as if she did, and Nora was fighting back tears. Marjorie went on.
"Or you can treat me with respect. If the Earl takes you to his bed, leave him as soon as he falls asleep, and return to the servants' quarters. Refuse to answer the questions the others ask you. In the daytime, don't look at him or speak to him, and never touch him in front of me or anyone else. Then, when he tires of you, you will still have a place here, and your life will return to normal. Do you understand the choice in front of you?"
"Yes, madam,"
Nora whispered. "Off you go."
As Nora opened the door, Marjorie added bitterly, "And when you take a husband for yourself, pick one who is not like mine." Nora scurried away, and Marjorie went to see about the cooking of the geese. Ned arrived at midday, wearing a costly black coat and a white lace collar, an outfit that was becoming the uniform for affluent Protestants, Marjorie had noticed. It looked a bit austere on Ned. She liked him in warm colours, green and gold. Marjorie's dog, Mick, licked Ned's hand. Bart, too, welcomed Ned in a friendly way, getting out the best wine for the midday dinner. That was a relief. Perhaps Bart had forgotten that Marjorie had wanted to marry Ned, or perhaps he did not care, because he had got her anyway. To men such as Bart, winning was all important. Bart was not a deep thinker, and he had never suspected Ned of planning the downfall and execution of Swithin. Bart had a different theory. He was convinced that Dan Cobley, the leader of the Puritans, had set the trap, as revenge on Sir Reginald and Rollo for the execution of his own father, and it was true that Dan still bore a poisonous grudge against Rollo. Marjorie also felt nervous about Stephen Lincoln, who joined them at table. Ned would guess Stephen's role in the Earl's household, but he would not say anything. The presence of priests in the homes of Catholic noblemen was universally known, but never acknowledged. Marjorie usually frowned on hypocrisy. The orphan, whose father was known, but never named. The nuns who shared a passionate love that everyone pretended not to notice. The unmarried housekeeper who bore a series of children, all resembling the priest who employed her. But in this case, the pretense worked in Marjorie's favour. However, she was not sure that Stephen would be as tactful as Ned. Stephen hated Queen Elizabeth, to whom Ned owed his entire career. And Ned had reason to hate the Catholic Church, which had punished his mother so cruelly for usury. It might be a tense dinner. Bart said amiably, "So, Ned, you're one of the Queen's most important advisers now, people tell me." There was only a touch of resentment in Bart's tone. He thought the Queen's counsellors should be earls, not the sons of merchants. But he also knew in his heart that he could never give the Queen guidance on the intricacies of European politics. "I work with Sir William Cecil, and have done for 12 years, Ned said. "He is the important one." "But she has made you a knight, and now Lord of Wigley." "I'm very grateful to Her Majesty." An unaccustomed feeling crept over Marjorie, sitting at the table and watching Ned as he talked. He had a quick intelligence, and his eyes crinkled with humour frequently. She sipped wine and wished this dinner could go on forever. Stephen Lincoln said, "What exactly do you do for Elizabeth, Sir Ned?" "I tried to give her early warning of burgeoning problems." Marjorie thought this sounded pat, as if Ned had been asked the question many times and always trotted out the same answer. Stephen gave a twisted grin. "Does that mean you spy on people who disagree with her?" Marjorie groaned inwardly. Stephen was going to be combative and spoil the atmosphere. Ned sat back and squared his shoulders. "She doesn't care if people disagree with her, as long as they keep their views to themselves. I would have expected you to know that, Stephen, as Earl Bart regularly pays the fine of 1 shilling a week for not going to church." Bart said grumpily, "I go to the big events at Kingsbridge Cathedral." "And very wise you are, if I may say so. But in Elizabeth's England, no one is tortured for their religion. and no one has been burned at the stake. A stark contrast with the reign of her predecessor, Queen Mary. Bart spoke again. What about the Northern Rebellion? Marjorie knew what he was talking about. Just before Christmas, a group of Catholic girls had taken up arms against Queen Elizabeth in the only rebellion of her reign so far. They had celebrated a Latin Mass in Durham Cathedral, occupied several other towns in the north, and marched toward Tutworth, where Mary, Queen of Scots, was imprisoned, with the evident intention of freeing her and proclaiming her Queen of England. But the uprising had gained little support. The Queen's forces had put it down quickly, and Mary Stuart remained a prisoner. Ned said, "It fizzled out." 500 men have been hanged, Bart said indignantly, by the Queen who complains of Mary Tudor's cruelty. Ned said mildly, "Men who try to overthrow the monarch are generally executed in every country in the world, I believe." Bart was a poor listener, like his father, and he responded as if he had not heard Ned. "The North is poor enough already, but it has been looted mercilessly, lands confiscated and all the livestock seized and driven south." Marjorie wondered whether this reminded Ned of how his own family had been mercilessly plundered by her father. But if he thought of that, he hid his pain. He was not flustered by Bart's tactless tirade, and Marjorie supposed that, spending his life among the Queen's advisers, Ned had learned how to remain calm during angry arguments. "I can tell you that the Queen has not received much booty," he said in a reasonable tone of voice, "certainly nothing approaching the cost to her of putting down the insurrection. The North is part of England. It should not be plundered like a foreign country. Then its people should behave like Englishmen and obey their Queen." Marjorie decided that this was a good moment to change the subject. "Ned, tell Bart about the problem in Wigley." "It's quickly stated, Bart. One of my tenant farmers has encroached on your land and has cleared a couple of acres of forest on your side of the river."
"Then throw him off it," Bart said.
"If you wish. I will simply tell him to stop using that land, of course."
"And if he disobeys?"
"I'll burn his crop." Marjorie knew that Ned was pretending to be harsh in order to reassure Bart. Bart did not realize he was being manipulated.
"It's what he deserves," he said in a tone of satisfaction. "These peasants know the boundaries better than anyone. If he has encroached, he's done so deliberately."
"I agree. But there might be a better solution," Ned said, as if he hardly cared one way or the other. "After all, when peasants prosper, their landlords do too. Suppose I give you 4 acres of woodland somewhere else, in exchange for the 2 already cleared. That way, we both gain." Bart looked reluctant, but clearly could not think of a counter-argument. However, he temporized.
"Let's pay a visit to Wigley together," he said.
He was not good at abstract thinking, Marjorie knew. He would much prefer to make a decision while looking at the land in question. Ned said, "Of course, I'd be glad to, especially if we can do so soon. I need to get back to London, now that my mother is buried." Marjorie felt a stab of disappointment, and realized she had been hoping Ned would stay in Kingsbridge longer. Bart said,
"How about next Friday?"
Ned felt impatient, but suppressed the feeling. Marjorie could tell by his face, though probably no one else noticed. Clearly he would have preferred to settle this trivial matter right away, so that he could get back to great affairs of state. He said,
"Could you make it Monday?"
Bart looked annoyed, and Marjorie knew he was offended that he, an earl, should be asked to hurry up by a mere knight.
"No, I'm afraid I can't," he said mulishly.
"Very well," said Ned. "Friday it is."
In the days following the funeral, Ned thought ahead to the time when he would meet his Maker, and asked himself whether he would be proud of the life he had led. He had dedicated himself to a vision, one he shared with Queen Elizabeth, of an England where no one was killed for his religion. Could he say he had done everything possible to defend that ideal? Perhaps the greatest danger was King Felipe of Spain. Felipe was constantly at war, often over religious differences. He fought the Ottoman Muslims in the Mediterranean Sea and the Dutch Protestants in the Netherlands. Sooner or later, Ned felt sure, he would turn his attention to England and the Anglican Church.
Spain was the richest and most powerful country in the world, and no one knew how to defend England. Ned shared his worry with his brother. "The only thing Queen Elizabeth will spend money on willingly is the navy," he said, "but we'll never have a fleet to match King Felipe's galleons." They were sitting in the dining room, finishing breakfast. Barney was about to leave for Coombe Harbour, where his ship was taking on stores for the next voyage. He had renamed the vessel Alice after their mother. "England doesn't need galleons," said Barney. Ned was startled by that. He was in the act of giving a sliver of smoked fish to Maddie, the tortoiseshell cat, daughter or perhaps granddaughter of his childhood pet. But he froze, looked up at Barney and said, "What do we need, in your opinion?" "The Spanish idea is to have big ships to transport hundreds of soldiers. Their tactic is to ram, so that the soldiers can board the enemy ship and overwhelm the crew." "That makes sense. And it often works. But galleons have a high aftercastle, with cabins for all the officers and noblemen on board. That structure acts like a sail that can't be adjusted, and pushes the ship in the direction of the wind, regardless of where the captain wants to go. In other words, it makes the ship harder to steer." The waiting cat made a plaintive noise, and Ned gave her the fish, then said, "If we don't need galleons, what do we need to protect ourselves?" "The Queen should build ships that are narrow and low, and therefore more manoeuvrable. An agile ship can dance around a galleon, firing at it without letting the galleon get close enough for all those soldiers to board. I have to tell her this. The other main factor in sea battles is speed of reloading." "Really? It's more important than having heavy guns. My sailors are trained to clean out the barrel and recharge the cannon rapidly and safely. With practice, they can do it in under 5 minutes. Once you're close enough to hit the enemy ship with every shot, it's all about the number of times you can fire. A relentless barrage of cannonballs will demoralize and devastate the enemy very quickly." Ned was fascinated. Elizabeth had no standing army, so the navy was England's only permanent military force. The country was not wealthy by European standards, but such prosperity as it had came from overseas trade. The navy was a formidable presence on the high seas, making others hesitate before attacking English merchant ships. In particular, the navy gave England dominance in the Channel, the waterway that separated the country from Europe. Elizabeth was parsimonious, but she had an eye for what was really important, and she paid careful attention to her ships. Barney got up. "I don't know when I'll see you again," he said. "I don't know if I'll ever see you again," Ned thought. He picked up Barney's heavy travelling coat and helped him on with it. "Be safe, Barney," he said. They parted company with little ceremony, in the manner of brothers. Ned went into the front parlour and sat at the writing table his mother had used for so many years. While the conversation was fresh in his mind, he made a note of everything Barney had said about the design of fighting ships. When he had finished, he looked out of the window at the west front of the cathedral. "I'm 30 years old, he thought. "When my father was this age, he already had Barney and me. In another 30 years, I may be lying in the cemetery next to my parents. But who will stand at my grave?" He saw Dan Cobley approaching the house, and put morbid thoughts out of his mind. Dan walked in. "Barney's just left," Ned said, assuming that Dan was there to talk about his investment in Barney's voyage. "He's taking the barge to Coombe Harbour, but you might catch him at the dock if you hurry." "My business with Barney is settled, to our mutual satisfaction," Dan said. "I've come to see you." "In that case, please sit down." At 32, Dan was plumper than ever, and still had a know-all air that struck Ned as adolescent. But Dan was a good businessman, and had expanded the enterprise he had inherited. He was now probably the richest man in Kingsbridge. He was looking for a bigger house, and had offered a good price for Priory Gate, though Rollo did not want to sell. Dan was also the undisputed leader of the town's Puritans, who liked to worship at St. John's Church in the suburb of Laversfield. As Ned feared, Dan had come to talk about religion. Dan leaned forward dramatically. "There is a Catholic among the clergy at Kingsbridge Cathedral," he said. "Is there?" Ned sighed. "How could you possibly know a thing like that?" Dan answered a different question. "His name is Father Paul." Paul Watson was a gentle old priest.
He had been the last prior of Kingsbridge, and he had probably never accepted the Reformed religion. And what is Father Paul's crime, exactly? Dan said triumphantly, "He celebrates Mass secretly in the crypt with the doors locked." "He's an old man," Ned said wearily. "It's hard for such people to keep changing their religious convictions." "He's a blasphemer!" "Yes, he is." Ned agreed with Dan about theology. He differed only about enforcement. "You've actually witnessed these illegal rites?" "I have watched people creeping furtively into the cathedral by a side door at dawn on Sunday, including several I've long suspected of backsliding into idolatry. Rollo Fitzgerald, for one, and his mother, Lady Jane, for another." "Have you told Bishop Luke?" "No. I'm sure he tolerates it." "Then what do you propose?" "Bishop Luke has to go."
"And I suppose you want Father Jeremiah from St. John's to be made bishop?"
Dan hesitated, surprised that Ned had read his intentions so easily. He cleared his throat. "That is for Her Majesty to decide," he said with insincere deference. "Only the monarch can appoint and dismiss bishops in the Anglican Church, as you know. But I want you to tell the Queen what is going on, and if you don't, I will."
"Let me explain something to you, Dan, though you're not going to like it. Elizabeth may dislike Catholics, but she hates Puritans. If I go to her with this story, she'll have me thrown out of the presence chamber. All she wants is peace."
"But the Mass is illegal as well as heretical,
and the law is not strictly enforced."
"How could you not have noticed? What is the point of a law if it's not enforced?"
"The point is to keep everyone reasonably content. Protestants are happy because the Mass is illegal. Catholics are happy because they can go to Mass anyway, and the Queen is happy because people are going about their business and not killing one another over religion. I strongly advise you not to complain to her. She won't do anything about Father Paul, but she might do something about you."
"This is outrageous," said Dan, standing up.
Ned did not want to quarrel. "I'm sorry to send you away with a dusty answer, Dan," he said, "but this is the way things are. I'd be misleading you if I said anything else."
"I appreciate your frankness,"
Dan said grudgingly, and they parted with at least the semblance of cordiality. 5 minutes later, Ned left the house. He walked up the main street, past Priory Gate, the house he would always think of as having been built with money stolen from his mother. He saw Rollo Fitzgerald emerge. Rollo was in his middle 30s now, and his black hair was receding, giving him a high forehead. When Sir Reginald died, Rollo had applied to take his place as receiver of customs at Coombe Harbour, but such plum posts were used by the sovereign to reward loyalty, and it had gone to a staunch Protestant, not surprisingly. However, the Fitzgerald family still had a large business as wool brokers, and Rollo was running that well enough, more competently than his father ever had. Ned did not speak to Rollo, but hurried on across the high street and went to a large old house near St. Mark's Church. Here lived what remained of the Kingsbridge monks. King Henry VIII had granted a small stipend to some of those he dispossessed, and the few, still alive, continued to receive their pensions. Father Paul came to the door, a bent figure with a red nose and wispy hair. He invited Ned into the parlour.
"I'm sorry you've lost your mother," Paul said simply. "She was a good woman."
The former Bishop Julius also lived here, and he was sitting in a corner, staring at nothing. He was demented and had lost all speech, but his face wore a furious expression, and he mumbled angry gibberish at the wall.
"It's good of you to take care of Julius," Ned said to Father Paul.
"It's what monks are supposed to do, look after the sick and the poor and the bereaved."
If more of them had remembered that, we might still have a monastery, Ned thought, but he kept it to himself.
"Of course," he said. "The legendary Caris, who founded the hospital, was a nun at Kingsbridge. Rest her soul."
Looking hopeful, Paul said, "A glass of wine, perhaps?" Ned hated the fuddling effect of wine in the morning.
"No, thank you. I won't stay long. I came to give you a word of warning."
An anxious frown crossed Paul's lined face.
"Oh, dear.
That sounds ominous.
It is, a little. I've been told that something is going on in the crypt at dawn on Sundays. Paul paled.
I have no idea.
Ned held up a hand to stall the interruption. I'm not asking you whether it's true, and there's no need for you to say anything at all. Paul was agitated, but quieted himself with a visible effort.
Very well. Whoever is using the crypt at that hour, for whatever purpose, should be warned that the town's Puritans are suspicious. To avoid trouble, perhaps the services, if that is what they are, should be moved to a different venue.
Paul swallowed.
I understand.
Her Majesty the Queen believes that religion was given to us for consolation in this life and salvation in the next, and that we may disagree about it, but we should never let it be a cause of violence between one Englishman and another.
Yes.
Perhaps I don't need to say any more.
I think I understand you perfectly.
And it might be best if you don't tell anyone that I came to see you.
Of course.
Ned shook Paul's hand. I'm glad we had a chance to talk.
Me too.
Goodbye, Father Paul.
God bless you, Ned, said Paul.
On Friday morning, Marjorie's husband felt ill. This was not unusual, especially after a good supper with plenty of wine the night before. However, today Earl Bart was supposed to go to Wigley and meet Sir Ned Willard.
You can't let Ned down, Marjorie said. He'll have ridden there specially.
You'll have to go instead of me,
Bart said from his bed.
You can tell me what it's all about.
Then he put his head under the blanket. Marjorie's spirits lifted at the prospect of spending an hour or two with Ned. Her heart seemed to beat faster, and her breath came in shallow gasps. She was glad Bart was not looking at her. But her reaction showed her how unwise it would be to do this.
I don't want to go, she lied. I've got so much to do here at the castle.
Bart's voice was muffled by the blanket, but his words were clear enough.
Don't be stupid, he said. Go!
Marjorie had to obey her husband. She ordered her best horse saddled, a big mare called Russet. She summoned the lady-in-waiting and the man-at-arms who usually accompanied her. They should be enough to keep her out of trouble. She changed into travelling clothes, a long blue coat and a red scarf and hat to keep the dust out of her hair. It was a practical outfit, she told herself, and she could not help it if the colours suited her complexion and the hat made her look cute. She kissed Bartlett goodbye. She whistled for her dog, Mick, who loved to accompany her on a ride. Then she set off. It was a fine spring day, and she decided to stop worrying and enjoy the sunshine and fresh air. She was 27 years old and a countess, rich and healthy and attractive. If she could not be happy, who could? She stopped at an inn on the road for a glass of beer and a piece of cheese. Mick, who seemed tireless, drank at the pond. The man-at-arms gave each horse a handful of oats. They reached Wigley in the early afternoon. It was a prosperous village, with some fields still cultivated on the old strip system, and others belonging to individual farmers. A fast stream drove an old watermill for fulling cloth, called Merthin's Mill. In the centre were a tavern, a church, and a small manor house. Ned was waiting in the tavern.
"Where's Bart?" he said. "He's sick,"
Marjorie replied. He looked surprised, then pleased, then apprehensive, all in quick succession, as he digested this news. Marjorie knew why he might be apprehensive. It was the risk of temptation. She felt the same anxiety. Ned said, "I hope it's not serious."
"No, it's the kind of illness a man suffers after drinking too much wine."
"Ah,
you get me instead. A poor substitute,"
she said with facetious modesty. He grinned happily. "No complaints here.
Shall we go to the site?
Don't you want something to eat and drink?" Marjorie did not want to sit in a stuffy room with half a dozen peasants staring at her.
"No, thank you," she said.
They rode a path between fields of spring green wheat and barley.
"Will you live in the manor house?"
Marjorie asked. "No, I'm too fond of the old house in Kingsbridge. I'll just use this place for a night or two when I need to visit." Marjorie was seized by a vision of herself creeping into Ned's house at night, and she had to put the wicked thought out of her mind. They came to the wood. The stream that drove the mill also marked part of the boundary of Wigley, and the land beyond belonged to the Earl. They followed the stream for a mile, then came to the location in question. Marjorie could see immediately what had happened. A peasant who was more enterprising than most, or greedier, or both, had cleared the forest on the Earl's side of the stream and was grazing sheep on the rough grass that had sprung up there. "Just beyond here is the patch I'm offering Bart in exchange," Ned said. Marjorie saw a place where the ground on the Wigley side was forested. They rode across the stream, then dismounted and walked the horses into the wood. Marjorie noted some mature oaks that would provide valuable timber. They stopped at a pretty clearing with wild flowers and a grassy bank beside the stream.
"I can't see why Bart would object to the exchange," Marjorie said. "In fact, I think we'll be getting a bargain."
"Good," said Ned. "Shall we rest here a while?" The prospect was delightful.
"Yes, please," she said.
They tethered the horses where they could crop some grass. Ned said, "We could send your people to the tavern for food and drink."
"Good idea."
Marjorie turned to the man-at-arms and the lady-in-waiting.
"You two, go back to the village. You can walk. The horses need a rest. Fetch a jug of ale and some cold ham and bread. And enough for yourselves, of course."
The two servants disappeared into the woods. Marjorie sat on the grass by the stream and Ned lay beside her. The wood was quiet. There was just the shush of the stream and the breath of a light breeze in the spring leaves. Mick lay down and closed his eyes, but he would wake and give warning if anyone approached. Marjorie said,
"Ned, I know what you did for Father Paul."
Ned raised his eyebrows. "News travels fast."
"I want to thank you."
"I suppose you supply the sacramental wafers." She was not sure what to say to that, but Ned quickly added, "I don't want to know the details. Please forget I asked."
"Just as long as you know that I would never conspire against Queen Elizabeth."
Marjorie wanted him to understand that.
"She is our anointed ruler. I may wonder why God, in his wisdom, chose to set a heretic on the throne, but it is not for me to challenge his choice."
Ned, still lying down, looked up at her and smiled. "I'm very glad to hear it." He touched her arm. She stared at his kind, clever face. What she saw in his eyes was a yearning so strong it might have broken her heart. No one else had ever felt like this about her, she knew. At that moment, it seemed that the only possible sin would be to reject his passion. She lowered her head and kissed his lips. She closed her eyes and gave herself up to the love that possessed her, filling her soul as the blood filled her body. She had thought about this ever since the last time they had kissed, though now, after such a long wait, it was even sweeter. She sucked his lower lip into her mouth, then teased his upper lip with the tip of her tongue, then pushed her tongue into his mouth. She could not get enough of him. He grasped her shoulders and pulled her down, until she was lying on top of him, putting all her weight on him. She could feel his erection through her petticoats. She worried that she might be hurting him and moved to roll off, but he held her in place. She relaxed into the feeling of being so close that they might melt into one another. There seemed nothing in the world except him and her, nothing outside their two bodies. Even this did not satisfy her for long. Everything they did made her want more. She knelt up, straddling Ned's knees, and opened the front of his breeches to free his penis. She stared at it, stroking it lovingly. It was pale and slightly curved, springing from a tangle of curly auburn hair. She bent over and kissed it, and heard him gasp with pleasure. A tiny drop of fluid appeared at the end. Unable to resist the temptation, she licked it off. She could wait no longer. She moved to straddle his hips, tenting the skirt of her dress over the middle of his body, then sank down, guiding his penis inside her. She was impossibly wet, and it slipped in effortlessly. She bent forward so that she could kiss him again. They rocked gently for a long time, and she wanted to do it forever. Then he was the one who wanted more. He rolled her over, without withdrawing. She spread her legs wide and lifted her knees. She wanted him deeper inside her, filling her up. She felt him losing control. She looked into his eyes and said, "It's you, Ned."
It's you.
She felt the jerking spasm and the rush of fluid, and that drove her over the edge, and she felt happy, truly happy, for the first time in years. Rollo Fitzgerald would have died rather than change his religion. For him, there was no room for compromise. The Catholic Church was right, and all rivals were wrong. It was obvious, and God would not forgive men who ignored the obvious. A man held his soul in his hand like a pearl, and if he were to drop that pearl in the ocean, he would never get it back. He could hardly believe that Elizabeth Tudor had lasted 12 years as the illegitimate Queen of England. She had given people a measure of religious freedom, and, amazingly, her religious settlement had not yet collapsed. The Catholic earls had failed to overthrow her, and all the monarchs of Europe had hesitated while she pretended she might marry a good Catholic. It was a terrible disappointment. Rollo would have believed that God was asleep, were it not a blasphemous thing to say. Then, in May of 1570, everything changed, not just for Rollo, but for everyone in England. Rollo got the news at breakfast in Priory Gate. His sister, Marjorie, was at the table. She was paying an extended visit to Kingsbridge to look after their mother, Lady Jane, who had been ill. Mother had recovered somewhat and was now at breakfast with them, but Marjorie seemed in no hurry to go home. The maid Peggy came in and handed Rollo a letter, saying a courier had brought it from London. It was a large piece of heavy paper, folded corners to middle, and closed with a blob of red wax impressed with the Fitzgerald seal. The handwriting was that of Davy Miller, the family's man of business in London. Davy's letters were normally about the price of wool, but this one was different. The Pope had made a formal announcement, called a papal bull. Such messages were not circulated in England, of course. Rollo had heard rumours about it, but now, according to Davy, someone had daringly nailed a copy to the gate of the Bishop of London's palace, so everyone knew what was in it. Rollo gasped when he read Davy's summary. Pope Pius V had excommunicated Queen Elizabeth.
"This is good news,"
Rollo said. "The Pope describes Elizabeth as the pretended Queen of England and the servant of crime. At last."
"Elizabeth must be furious," Marjorie said. "I wonder if Ned Willard knows about this."
Lady Jane said darkly, "Ned Willard knows everything."
"It gets better,"
Rollo said jubilantly. "Englishmen are released from their allegiance to Elizabeth, even if they have sworn oaths." Marjorie frowned.
"I'm not sure you should be so pleased," she said. "This means trouble."
"But it's true.
Elizabeth is a heretic and an illegitimate queen. No one should obey her." Lady Jane said,
"Your sister's right, Rollo. This may not be good news for us."
Rollo carried on reading. "In fact, people are commanded not to obey her, and anyone who does obey is included in the sentence of excommunication." Marjorie said,
"This is a catastrophe."
Rollo did not understand them. "It needs to be said, and the Pope is saying it at last. How can this be bad news?"
"Don't you see what it means, Rollo?"
said Marjorie. "The Pope has turned every English Catholic into a traitor.
He's only making plain what everyone knows."
"Sometimes it's better not to say what everyone knows."
"How is that possible?"
"Everyone knows that Father Paul celebrates Mass for us, and Stephen Lincoln too, and all the other secret priests. But no one says it. That's the only reason we get away with it. Now it's under threat. We're all potential traitors."
Rollo saw what they meant, but they were wrong. People were stupid, and freedom was dizzyingly perilous. Men had to fight against Elizabeth's heresy, even if it made life uncomfortable or even dangerous.
"You women don't understand politics," he said.
Marjorie's son Bartlett came into the room. Rollo looked at the boy with pride. Bartlett was his nephew, and would one day be the Earl of Shiring.
"Can we play with the kittens today?"
Bartlett said.
"Of course, my darling," said Marjorie.
She explained, "Ned's tortoiseshell cat has had kittens, and Bartlett's fascinated by them." Lady Jane said,
"I wouldn't stay too long at the Willard house if I were you."
Rollo wondered why his mother's tone was so frosty. Then he recalled the struggle to make Marjorie marry Bart rather than Ned.
That was ancient history, but perhaps Lady Jane feared people would think Margery had an ulterior motive in going to Ned's house. Perhaps she did. Rollo dismissed the thought. He had more important things on his mind. "I've got to go to a meeting of the Borough Council," he said. "I'll see you all at dinner." He kissed his mother and went out. Kingsbridge was ruled by a council of 12 aldermen, all local merchants, chaired by the mayor. Rollo had taken his father's place as an alderman when he inherited the family's wool business, but the current mayor was Elijah Cordner, a crony of Dan Cobley's. The council met in the Guildhall, as they had for hundreds of years. Rollo walked up the main street to the crossroads, went into the Guildhall, and climbed the stairs to the council chamber, conscious that he was about to take part in a venerable tradition. The room was panelled in smoke-blackened wood. Leather chairs were arranged around a conference table that was scored with ancient graffiti. On a sideboard was a round of beef and a jug of ale, for anyone who had not had time for breakfast. Rollo took his place. He was the only Catholic in the room. None of the other aldermen had ever appeared at one of Father Paul's clandestine services. Rollo felt vaguely intimidated, as if he were a spy among enemies. He had not felt this way before, and he wondered if that was because of the papal bull. Perhaps Margery was right. He hoped not. The council regulated commerce and industry in the city, and the morning's business was about weights and measures, wages and prices, masters and apprentices. It was reported that some visiting tradesmen at the market were using the banned Tower Pound, which was lighter than the approved Troy Pound. They discussed a rumour that Queen Elizabeth might standardise a mile at 5,280 feet instead of 5,000. They were about to break up for midday dinner when Mayor Cordner announced a last-minute addition to the agenda, the papal bull. Rollo was puzzled. The council never discussed religion. What was this about? Cordner said, "Unfortunately, the Pope in Rome has seen fit to order Englishmen not to obey Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth." Rollo said irritably, "What has that to do with this council?" Cordner looked uncomfortable and said, "Well, Alderman Cobley feels it may raise questions." So Dan Cobley was up to something, Rollo thought. That made him anxious. Dan still blamed him for the execution of Filbert and lusted for vengeance. Everyone looked at Dan. "It would be a bad thing if the shadow of treason were to fall on the borough of Kingsbridge," Dan said, clearly making a rehearsed speech. "I'm sure you all agree." There was a mutter of agreement around the table. Margery had said at breakfast that the bull made traitors of all Catholics, and Rollo now felt a dark foreboding. "To avoid all suspicion," Dan went on, "I have a simple suggestion. All Kingsbridge merchants should swear to the 39 articles." The room fell silent. Everyone knew what this meant. It was a direct attack on Rollo. The 39 articles defined the doctrine of the Anglican Church. Any Catholic who accepted them would be betraying his faith. Rollo would die rather than take such an oath. And everyone in the room knew that. Not all Kingsbridge Protestants were as hardline as Dan. Most of them wanted nothing more than to do business in peace. But Dan could be slyly persuasive. Paul Tinsley, the lawyer who was clerk of the peace for the town, said, "There have been several attempts by Parliament to make all public officials take an oath affirming the articles, but Queen Elizabeth has always refused to ratify any such legislation." Dan said, "She won't refuse next time it comes up. Not after this bull. She's going to have to clamp down." "Perhaps," said Tinsley, "but we could wait until Parliament makes a decision rather than take the matter into our own hands." "Why wait?" said Dan. "Surely there is no one in this room who denies the truth of the articles? And if there is, should he be allowed to trade in Kingsbridge after this papal bull?" Tinsley persisted in his mild tone of voice. "You may well be right, Alderman Cobley. I'm suggesting merely that we should not act in haste." Rollo spoke up. "Alderman Tinsley is right. I, for one, will not sign a religious declaration put in front of me by Alderman Cobley." Untruthfully, he added, "If Her Majesty the Queen should ask for it, that would be a different matter." It would not. But Rollo was desperate. His livelihood was at stake. Dan said, "What if word got around that we have had this discussion and decided not to act? Won't that put us under suspicion?"
Around the table there were several reluctant nods, and Rollo began to think Dan would get his way. Cordoner said, "I think we must take a vote. Those in favour of Alderman Cobley's proposal, please raise your hands." 10 hands went up. Only Rollo and Tinsley were against. Cordoner said, "The resolution is passed." Rollo stood up and left the room.
Marjorie lay in bed at Newcastle early on a July morning, listening to the birds. She felt happy, guilty, and scared. She was happy because she loved Ned, and he loved her. He had stayed in Kingsbridge all through May, and they had met several times a week. Then he had been ordered to report on South Coast defences. It was Marjorie's normal practice to go with Stephen Lincoln at least once a week to celebrate Mass clandestinely in remote villages and suburban barns, and she and Ned contrived to make their paths cross. They would manage